Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
BP is worth $70 billion less right now than it was when the oil leak started. Today, the finger-pointing over whose fault that leak was officially started. And get this, BP says there is plenty of blame to go around. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Payroll Association in recognition of payroll professionals during National Payroll Week, September 6th through the 10th. More at nationalpayrollweek.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 8th of September, the calendar says, and it is good to have you here. The executive summary of BP's big report on the oil spill goes a little something like this. It's complicated. The report lays out the details of just what happened in the Gulf of Mexico on April 20th when the Deepwater Horizon rig caught fire and 11 workers died. Marketplace's Eve Troe is here to tell us what BP is saying and not saying about the whole thing. Hey, Eve.
Hi.
So what did BP have to tell us in this report today?
BP had a lot to say. They got more than 50 specialists together. Many of those were from within the company. They started working on this report a few weeks after the spill, so they've been at it for months. And they came up with 8 reasons, a mix of human and technical mistakes that led to this whole disaster. The story really starts with cement. They say that all the cement was poured down, and crews thought that things were okay. They started pumping water and mud in and out of the well. And then several hours later, up comes oil and gas and mud, gets all over the rig, lights it on fire. Then, while the rig is on fire, the blowout preventer doesn't work. And that's when all this oil starts flowing into the Gulf.
There was no admission of guilt or blame or fault here from BP, was there?
Well, a little bit. You know, BP did write this report, and on many of these 8 items, they said that they and someone else had something to do with it. But they're not taking full responsibility by any means. They say, for instance, that the blowout preventer had pretty much nothing to do with them, and that was just hauled out of the water last week, so there'll be a lot of investigating of that. They also point a finger to the cement, and that's something that Halliburton made. They also point the finger at Transocean. That's the company that actually owns the rig. So a lot of the workers were Transocean workers, and BP says they didn't react correctly when they did see signs of trouble. For instance, when that oil and gas started coming up, they should have made it shoot over the edge and not onto the rig itself. BP does say that its own engineers misread a few tests, and they say from the get-go, you know, our report is not the final word. These partner companies definitely agree with that. They're not going to let BP throw them under the bus. In fact, Transocean is already saying that this whole report is just to cover up BP's faulty design of the well to begin with.
Well, and it has to be read a little bit as BP trying to lay the groundwork for what will be and already are bunches of lawsuits.
Yes, this is true. BP is already facing lawsuits from individuals and from businesses. It could face lawsuits from states. There will be a federal investigation by the U.S. Justice Department. So if it can spread around this liability, it could owe less money in damages down the line.
I'm going to get a little bit wonky on you here and go to the bond market. BP's debt rating, its credit rating, was actually upgraded today.
Yes, it was. You know, congratulations to BP on their A. The ratings agency Fitch upgraded them from a triple B to an A. They got that triple B after the spill. That's just a couple marks above a junk rating. And there are a few reasons that they got this high mark today. One is that, you know, the well in the Gulf has been capped. So this creates a whole different scenario where we can start really assessing what the liability scenarios will be. This report is part of that. So again, it comes back to knowing what will happen here, having a sense of what might happen. BP's also been selling a ton of its assets, so it actually has some cash on hand to pay for all this mess, whatever its part in it might end up being.
Right. Marketplace's Eve Troe from the Sustainability Desk on BP's 190-some-odd page report today on that oil spill. Eve, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
President Obama made the rounds of Parma, Ohio today talking economy. The White House and congressional Republicans are arguing over, well, they're arguing over many things, to be honest with you. Today, it was whether to end the Bush tax cuts. Those are the ones geared mostly toward Americans earning more than $250,000 a year. The figure you hear is that that's about 3% of the country, and $250,000 is a lot of money. But the tax debate and maybe the tax structure itself doesn't capture how rich a small slice of that 3% group really is. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
It used to be Americans had a clearer idea of what it was to be rich. In the 1950s, the wealthiest Americans paid taxes of up to 90 cents on the dollar, but historians say the gap back then between rich and poor was smaller. At the American Enterprise Institute, Economic Policies Director Kevin Hassett says the rich started pulling further ahead in the 1970s, and recently that's accelerated rapidly.
Income distribution got much more skewed over the last decade towards the top.
By some estimates, in the 5 years leading up to the recession, the incomes of the top 1% of Americans grew almost 10 times faster than everyone else, accounting for the bulk of the nation's increased wealth. Stephen Rose is a labor economist at Georgetown University. He says the income tax system hasn't changed while that wealth shifted, and many wage earners that Uncle Sam classifies as rich pay the same high tax margins as the super rich.
Income taxes are somewhat targeted for the upper middle class and less targeted for the super elite.
Rose says there's been no groundswell as yet to create a higher tax rate for those Americans, but a Quinnipiac University poll out this year did find strong support, including among Republicans, for a tax on millionaires. If that happened, Rose says the richest of the rich would still be better off than they were not so long ago.
As recently as the Reagan era, the tax rate on people who made the equivalent of $1 million a year was much higher than it is today. So we really would only be going back.
Rose says defining who's rich, though, isn't an issue for economists as much as it is a political challenge. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Not too many challenges on Wall Street today. All three major indices ended on the plus side of the ledger. We will have details when we do the numbers. The economic debate that's happening right now isn't really about the economy. It's all politics and election day and which party looks like they're doing more to get things back on track. That's the not-so-subtle subtext of the president's new plan for business tax breaks, because Republicans and companies have been in favor of them for years. Commentator Robert Reich, not so much, and especially not now.
The economy needs two whopping corporate tax cuts right now as much as someone with a serious heart condition needs Botox. The reason businesses aren't investing in new plants and equipment has nothing to do with the cost of capital. It's because they don't need the additional capacity. Consumers aren't buying enough. They're still under a huge debt load. They have to start saving because their nest eggs are worth substantially less, and they've lost or are worried about losing their jobs and pay. Obama's proposed corporate tax cuts won't generate more jobs because they won't put any more money in workers' pockets. Corporate lobbyists have been seeking these tax cuts because corporations are investing in automated equipment and software. These investments are designed to boost profits by permanently replacing workers and cutting payrolls. The tax cuts Obama is proposing, therefore, would make such investments all the more profitable. Obama is proposing them in order to put Republicans in a bind. If they refuse to go along, he can justifiably say they have no agenda other than obstruction. After all, the only thing they've been arguing for is lower taxes. On the other hand, if Republicans agree to support these corporate tax cuts, Obama can claim a legislative victory that will help Democrats neutralize their opponents in the upcoming elections. The proposals also make it harder for Republicans to argue the Bush income tax cuts should be extended for the richest 3% of taxpayers because small businesses need it. Obama's corporate tax cuts would appear to do the trick for small business. The White House probably figures, even if Republicans agree, nothing will come of it. Congress will be in session for only about 2 weeks between now and the midterm elections, so it's doubtful they'd be enacted in any event. But this could backfire if Republicans call Obama's bluff and demand the corporate tax cuts be put on a fast track and get signed into legislation before the midterms. More troubling, Obama's whopping proposed corporate tax cuts help legitimize the supply-side dogma that the economy's biggest obstacle to growth is the cost of capital, rather than the plight of ordinary working people.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Next week, in his regular spot right about here in the Wednesday broadcast, commentator David Frum. Take a minute to send along your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. There are, by some counts, 5 people going after every open job that's out there. For kids just out of college, it's worse. They're competing with 2 or maybe 3 years' worth of graduates who are still trying to find their first jobs. That's especially true in the more popular lines of work, high tech and social media in particular. So younger applicants are coming up with some creative ways to get a virtual foot in the interview door. Youth Radio's Maya Cueva reports.
Alec Brownstein needed to get noticed. The 29-year-old copywriter left an advertising company he says wasn't creative enough. He jumped right into a job search, focusing on 6 big ad agencies in Manhattan. Given the competition, Brownstein decided against the old-fashioned application process, just sending in a resume. He took a more direct approach.
I was doing a bit of research on Google about the agency I wanted to work for and about the creative directors who I wanted to work for. As I was Googling them and I was looking through their results, I noticed that there were no ads at the top of the page or even on the side of the page. So as someone who Googles myself somewhat frequently, I realized that if there was an ad above my results, I would notice it when I Googled myself.
So that's just what Brownstein did for the executives he hoped to work for. When they Googled themselves, they would see Brownstein's ads asking for a job and directing them to his website. Total cost of placing the ads, $6. He bid on the AdWords and waited. On the other side of the country, 2 20-somethings used social media to apply to the social news site Digg.com. Digg publisher and chief revenue officer Chaz Edwards says the company receives hundreds of resumes each month from hopeful employees. But instead of the typical route, these 2 applicants took out Facebook ads about themselves, targeting people who work at Digg.
So when I logged into Facebook, I saw an ad that was directed at me, basically, that me and other people at Digg, that was someone said, I would like to work at Digg, click here to find out my credentials. And it caught my attention, and both young men got interviews.
And Edwards hired one of them. He says just posting your resume and waiting for a callback is like a shot in the dark. But new media strategies establish a direct relationship with the possible hiring manager. And they show you're an innovator in a field packed with web-savvy creative types.
I get a clear sense that these 2 young men really want to work at Digg. They're not just looking for any old job. They've gone to the effort to reach out to Digg. And I think the same thing about if people are following me in Twitter and replying to me in Twitter and we get to build a relationship, I'm much more inclined to invite them in for an interview than somebody who comes in by way of Craigslist.
Alec Brownstein's Google ad strategy didn't get an immediate reaction, but eventually the emails started trickling in.
And they all said the same thing, which was somebody else was Googling me and told me about this. But we thought it was really cool and we liked your portfolio of work. Would you like to come in for an interview?
Not only did Brownstein get one of the advertising jobs he interviewed for, he won some industry awards for the creativity of his job search. I'm Maya Cueva for Marketplace.
Maya's story was produced for us by Youth Radio. Coming up.
Natural or green or environmentally friendly can mean anything. It can mean nothing at all.
Sustainable beauty can be more than skin deep. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 46 points today, about 0.4% for the blue chips, ended at 10,387. The NASDAQ climbed 19 points, 0.9%, finished at 2228. The S&P 500 rose 7 points, 0.6%, closed at 1,098. Apple rallied about 2% after UBS raised its profit estimates on the tech company, but Hewlett-Packard unpacked 2.75% today. Intel chipped off 1.2% after UBS downgraded both companies' shares there. That report BP issued about its Gulf oil spill spiffed up its stock more than 3% today. Shares of the companies it fingered as partly responsible drifted up too. Transocean, operator of the rig, as Eve said, rose 1.3%. Halliburton, the company that cemented the well, gained 1.25%. The 10-year T-note fell. The yield thus rose to 2.65% in this case. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, with financial professionals nationwide who are trained to serve the unique financial needs of their clients at massmutual.com. by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for July. A sure sign of fall, the NFL season kicks off. The Saints go marching in to defend their championship against the Vikings. And former NFL quarterback for the Washington Redskins, Joe Theismann, turned 61. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Google rolled out a new tweak to its search engine today. It's called Google Instant. The thing makes suggestions for what you want, predicting what you're searching for before you can even get all the letters down. The company says it will save 2 to 5 seconds per search by refining your results as you type. Because somehow 400,000 hits on whatever you're looking for in like 0.3 seconds just isn't fast enough. Well, in fact, it's not. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports the new bells and whistles are all about advertisers and mobile and eventually you.
Google officially unveiled its new speedier search engine at a press conference today.
We're here in San Francisco. Why don't you use Google to check out the weather?
Sure. With exactly one key press on W, I can get a weather forecast for San Francisco.
Woo.
60 degrees.
And sunny, as far as advertisers are concerned, says the Yankee Group's Carl Howe. He says saving a few keystrokes and a few seconds will actually help Google sell more ads.
This reduces the amount of time between somebody visiting Google and somebody seeing one of their ads.
And should really speed things up on mobile devices. Google Instant is expected to go mobile within the next few months. Tara Kalashane is the editor of Research Buzz.
Having the pages and the suggestions preload, it's going to make searching on my phone a lot easier.
Google is also hoping Instant will give it an edge against Facebook, iPhone apps, and other competitors who are eating into its search business. Google Instant suggestions are based on the most popular searches and then targeted more specifically to you. Yankee Group's Carl Howe says Google uses what it knows about your past searches to give you more relevant results.
I just typed in B. And since I live in Boston, the first entry I get is Boston.
Okay, I'm typing in B. Oh, the first thing that came up was Best Buy. I don't know what this
is. There you
is.
Go.
Howe says Google has massive amounts of information on us, our searches, our emails, and it's been in a big push to find new ways to leverage that data. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
One more thing on Google to close the loop on my final note from last night. Me asking for help on the Google logo on its homepage yesterday, how to change to those weird bouncing balls. There was some feeling among you that it was Google's way of celebrating its birthday, early September being the generally accepted date range. Marketplace listener consensus, though, seems to be that it was a demonstration of HTML5 and something called CSS3. Those are computer programming languages. So now I know, and thank you. And yes, I know I could have Googled it, but this was more fun. Anybody who spends a lot of time in front of a computer has had their fair share of freeze-ups and glitches, often followed by something like, oh, come on, or not now, or other things you can't say on a family radio program. If you think about it, you're basically responding to your computer the way you might respond to a person who had done something to you. In his latest book, The Man Who Lied to His Laptop, Clifford Nass explores our relationship with technology and what that might mean for good old human interaction. Cliff, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
How do you know what you know about how people and computers and technology interact? I mean, is this lab work you've been doing?
Exactly. We've done over 100 experiments in the laboratory with people, with a large number of people, all types of people, to understand not just how people treat technology, but even more importantly, how people can effectively treat each other.
All right. Well, let's take the technology part first, because, I mean, a computer is a tool, right? You sit down, you log in, you do your work, you go home and check your email, and that's the end of it.
Well, people often think that computers are only a tool, but in fact, our research has shown that people apply an enormous range of social rules and expectations when dealing with computers and other technologies. So even though they deny it, and even though they don't know it, they actually have amazingly rich social relationships with even the simplest computer.
All right, that sounds a little weird, I got to tell you.
It is weird, and it surprised the heck out of us. But in study after study, we found people being polite to computers, treating computers like their teammates, accepting flattery from a computer.
Give me an example. I mean, this is more than somebody just saying, oh, I love my iPhone, man.
Exactly. So, for example, if you asked me how I like your show, I'd obviously say extremely positive things, of course.
Of course.
And the reason is we want to be polite to people that ask about themselves. In our study, we had people work with a computer, and then either the computer they worked with or a computer across the room said, how well did the computer do? And sure enough, people said nicer things to the computer that asked about itself. Our brains tell us when we're dealing with something that uses language or interacts with us, we have to treat it like a person.
So if computers give us feedback that is positive and warm, and I'm trying to imagine an example, and maybe you can help me with that, but if they give us feedback that is positive and warm and good, then we will be more productive human beings.
Absolutely. Right now, when you get your spelling checked, all it does is tell you wrong, 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 wrong.
That's right.
But what if the computer said to you, gee, I notice your spelling's improving, whether in fact it's improving or not. It turns out that not only do people like the computer more, they actually think it caught more errors and are willing to pay more for it.
Play this out for me in a human-to-human relationship in the office every day. How might this apply?
For example, in the case of flattery, generally when we see people in the office, we're very quick to tell them negative things they did wrong. And in fact, what the research shows is the opposite is much better. We should be much more aggressive and active in praising and much less active and aggressive in criticizing.
This is going to sound terrible, but this whole conversation makes me despair a little bit for human beings. We're just so shallow that we're so easily manipulable.
You can look at it that way, that this is manipulation, or we can look at it the reason that we evolve rules of politeness and such, which is one of our goals should be to make people happier and better. And if these rules will help our friends and colleagues be happier and better and create better relationships for us, I don't think that's manipulation. I think that's really serving a public good.
Cliff Nass teaches at Stanford University. His book is called The Man Who Lied to His Laptop, What Machines Tell Us About Human Relationship. Cliff, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm not really a manicure guy. I figure my nails look just fine the way they are. There are plenty of people, though, male and female, who like a good buff and polish every now and then. Many of whom, it turns out, want their beauty salon products to be good for the environment, too. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrienne Hill reports.
I don't have great nails. I bite them. Once in a while, when they get really bad, I pay $12 to get them painted, and in the process, expose myself to some pretty serious chemicals that also smell awful. My olfactory displeasure isn't uncommon.
I remember when I was younger and I would paint my nails in the living room and my dad would get really mad because it smelled the whole house up forever.
That's Melissa Tournay. She owns Primrose Organic Salon and Boutique, one of a growing number of eco-friendly salons. She invites me to take a whiff of the nail polish remover they use at the salon.
Wow. And we can be doing a manicure in here, and you can walk by and not even notice someone's painting them.
I'm not lightheaded, and it actually smells pretty good. A far cry from the acetone-based remover I have under the sink, which is poisonous. The polish in the salon is also free from phthalates, chemicals which may be linked to reproductive problems, and formaldehyde, a chemical the EPA considers a probable human carcinogen. An eco-manicure here at Primrose costs $20.
I think everyone's realized that you have to pay a little bit more. Just like when you go to the grocery store, you can choose between a non-organic orange or an organic orange.
Tournay says business has been good since she opened a year and a half ago. The hardest part of her business isn't trying to figure out how to make natural products work for clients. It's figuring out which products are actually natural.
You really need to be skeptical of the claims.
Jane Houlihan is with the Environmental Working Group.
Natural or green or environmentally friendly can mean anything. It can mean nothing at all.
Houlihan says there's a whole lot of greenwashing in the beauty products industry, in part because there's not much regulation. The lack of standards for green beauty products has spurred Whole Foods grocery store to launch its own certification. The beauty company Sephora also has its own internal guidelines for what products it'll advertise as natural, a standard that does allow for some synthetic ingredients. But generally, Houlihan says, the green cosmetics industry is wide open.
Companies can use almost any ingredient they choose and make almost any marketing claim they choose. Things like natural or hypoallergenic, there really aren't standards for those claims.
In spite of the lack of set standards for eco-friendly beauty products, the demand continues to grow. Tone Van Beek is an analyst with Ibis World. He says the green beauty biz has expanded at a rate of more than 7% a year over the last 7 years. That's better than the overall cosmetics industry.
Consumers are looking for these products such as natural cosmetics, which includes the likes of green tea, algae, mushroom extracts, and even chocolate.
Van Beek says sales are being driven more by marketing than actual product innovation. Although I have to tell you, fingernail polish remover that smells good seems like a pretty good innovation to me. Now I've just got to stop biting my nails. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which a little bit of technology might just be too much. You know the OnStar system from GM?
Hello and welcome to OnStar.
You press that blue button, you get the voice to call roadside assistance for you or help if you had an accident or something, or as it turns out, it can read you your Facebook updates. I kid you not, the Detroit Free Press says GM is working on a deal where you can get Facebook read to you as you drive. They're doing it because, I guess they're doing it because they can. I don't know. Anyway, my update for right now is that we are out of here. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 46 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 19 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 added 7 points, 0.6%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, in Memphis, Tennessee, it's the tale of two recessions.
We've got a lot of high-wage positions that have been downsized, but low-wage workers, they're going to feel the recession in a different way.
The worst of times and the worst of times. I suppose I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.